God is Love, a sermon preached in Chickering Hall, Boston, in the month of July 1891. The author and deliverer of this lecture was Lanson Norcross, who at the time was the pastor of the Church of Christ Scientist. God is love. 1 John chapter 4, verse 8. Three short words, three little words, if considered only etymologically. They are so short, so simple, that a little child, just exploring its way out into the world of talk, can easily repeat them, can readily learn to spell them. Simple indeed they are, yet what marvelous depth, sweetness, brightness, life, truth, joy, and power are in them. Mild, yet powerful, gentle, but possessing a fullness, a majesty, which makes them the most wonderful of words. When our finite thought takes in their completeness, their fullness, their compass, and their all-exclusiveness, it will be finite thought no more. But can finite thought grasp them? No, never. The most it can do is to begin with them, for when the finite sense has vanished, the divine consciousness will stand, fully understanding the infinite magnitude of these words. For then all speech will be but multitudinous expressions of the one thought, God is love, and love is God. Love will be all in all. Before drawing out the lesson these words have for us, it would not be amiss to call attention to the fact that humanity is beginning to awaken to its need, its hunger for love. Witness the sermons and utterances which pour in from a thousand sources, all attesting this one thing. Why, our age is beginning to become ironic instead of polemic. Say beginning, for it has not advanced far along this line. For when it does advance in the heavenly way, how it must chemicalize. It must unlearn all it has learned. It will learn that its sense of love is not love at all. A new creation will begin at this initial point, for it will then be seen that love is not a thing of the carnal senses at all. Beginning at this point, let it be sharply observed that the proper exposition or unfolding of these sweet mystic words, God is love, belongs to Christian Science, and to Christian Science alone. I say this in no spirit of boasting or vainglory, but simply because the budding, dawning experience of truth reveals it so to all of us who are in this new and living way. Christian Science alone explains these words, and only those who are willing to listen to Christian Science can hope to attain to their glorious realization. For is it not a fundamental article of Christian Science that God, the infinite, is impersonal and manifests himself only in impersonal modes and forms of action? He is life, and in him is no darkness at all. He is truth. He is substance. He is all in all. For beside him and his ideas, there can be nothing at all. These words, God is love, afford a capital, a beautiful illustration of the truth of the foregoing statements. I wish to call close, even critical attention to them. You will notice that John does not say that God loves you or me or him or anybody or anything at all, which runs in the line of our popular apprehensions of the subject. apprehensions, by the way, which are the source of half of the world's misdoings. He flashes out on us, in star-like fashion, his grand comprehensive statement, God is love. But you will inquire in some amazement, is not this the same as saying that God loves each of us individually, in accord with our limited human sense, which is actually the begetter of all our sin, misery, sickness and death? I answer, no, it is not. It is as widely apart from it as heaven is from earth. I wish, if it be possible, my hearers, to show you that John's simple yet magnificent statement, God is love, is not at all in line with our popular misapprehension that God loves us in the sense we usually suppose him to. I ought to say at this juncture that in an infinitely higher, purer, sweeter sense than we can conceive of, God does love us, one and all. But we do violence to that lofty sense of it when we allow ourselves to make use of our common modes of saying it. The trouble is not so much with the fact as with our sensual, anthropomorphic way of uttering it. We would do well not to make use of it till we can rise high enough to learn in what sense God really does love us, one and all. A few familiar and concrete examples will serve to bring out my meaning the more forcibly. Thus, we often make use in our common everyday speech of such expressions as these: I love my child dearly. My brother or my sister is very dear to me. I have a strong affection for my wife or my mother. And we all know how we begin and close the customary correspondence when absent from them as dear brother and yours affectionately. Have you never spoken in this way? John is my favourite brother, Mary or Susan is my favourite sister or cousin. And in many an ideal home, there has been a sense of wounded smart, kept hidden, it may be, from prying eyes, because some one member of the family was more esteemed and loved than the others. No matter whether real or imaginary, or whether we be conscious of it or not, it is so common as to be the rule and not the exception. To what does this testify? What does it really mean? You may never have bestowed much thought upon this phase of human life, but I ask you to analyze it closely, for when you have done so in the spiritual light of a testing or judgment day experience, you will not detect a fearfully selfish and worldly sense of mine and thine in it. Will you not see that all your little world would centre right in and around that one darling object, he or she, i.e. the loved, idolized brother, sister, wife, mother or friend, is all the world to you, and how you desire that you shall be all the world to him or her? Little world, did I say? Yes, indeed, it is painfully small, narrow and bitter. What a fearful perversity of meaning clings around those hateful words, idol and idolatry. In how many orthodox homes they are enshrined. My hearers, when you have gone clear through with this analysis or investigation, you discover that in reality it means precisely this: that while you have no wish to be cruel or heartless, yet they are not in your little world. You hardly think of loving them, then practically, so far as you are concerned, they must find love and lovers elsewhere. Thus, if your mother or sister gets crushed in the railroad accident or blown up with a steamboat, you mourn bitterly. The joy and light of many days have gone out of your household. But how about the countless mothers, brothers and sisters who are daily being crushed and maimed? Can you not see that society, as it exists on this plane of belief, is organized selfishness? I have not time to follow out the modes and manifestations of it. In the golden light of our text, we learn that God is love, but surely God loves in no such partial human sense as this we have just seen. If now we want a comparison that shall help us, we have to make use of such comparisons, I would say that God loves in something of the same way as the sun shines. When yonder brilliant orb of day came up out of the sea this morning and burst in soft radiance over our lower world, enveloped in darkness, how did it shine? Was there a sense of discrimination in it? Did it go round to the tall mansion on Beacon Hill and pour down resplendent bars of light and warmth on that, withdrawing at the same time something of its brilliancy and sweetness from the hovel of the poor outcast down in the purlieus of the great city? Does the sun hunt out, in our human fashion, the cedar of Lebanon, the stately oak tree and the rose bush, while it daintily turns away from the lowly and bent sapling, or haughtily withdraws its rays from the poor garden weed your scorn will pull up tomorrow? Oh no. The glorious sun shines because of the joy there is in shining, and the joy also of shining on all. So love pours out love on all, because it is love. Love, real spiritual love, and there is no other, can no more discriminate than sunshine can discriminate. Were God to love in any other way, he would cease to be God. But do you say we are not to love in this beautiful way, that here in this world it is impossible? Indeed. Are we then not made in God's image? Surely it ought not to be wrong to be like God. And so if our finite sense tells us, as it does, that all this divine beauty and love are made for some other sphere of existence, the sooner we rise in rebellion against such a state of things, the better for our peace and spiritual growth. Our enemies sometimes say of us in scorn that we are trying to obliterate, banish all human distinctions. No, we are not. Or rather, if we do have that high aim continually before our eyes, we expect to realize it easily, naturally, and not by overturning existing institutions. We are not iconoclasts, in the ordinary sense of that word, i.e., mere image breakers. We would not supplant until we can build and restore a better, diviner order of things. Certainly we ask for nothing that is unreasonable, nothing that is out of line with real progress. And so, when we can say we can and ought to love in the supreme and impersonal sense, do not, I beg of you, misunderstand me. Do not think I am teaching that we should be unmindful of existing ties and relations, that we should love the mother or wife or child less, but only that by gaining this higher sense of impersonality, we begin to love them now as they should be loved. But let us advance a step in our thought. Notice in the next place that with God or love, there is not an iota of our human self-consciousness manifest in its expression. I ask you to notice with care the way I stated this fact. I did not say consciousness, but self-consciousness. Since God is all there is, And since he is all holiness and purity, all consciousness must be expressed in him. But self-consciousness, which is found in a personal sense of that consciousness, is utterly wanting, by which I mean that sense of it which admits of states and degrees of condition. Here again, familiar and pat illustrations step in to assist us. You say quite often, do you not, that you are conscious of loving your brother, let us suppose, or some friend. But have you ever thought what that statement really implies? Do you not clearly perceive that there is a time element in it which admits of degrees of comparison? You find, on looking into the matter, that you do not have quite the same feeling toward him yesterday that you do now, and you are conscious you may not feel quite the same way toward him tomorrow. He did something, or you did something, it matters not which, so far as the principle is concerned, that interposed a barrier between you, a strained relationship, as it were. And so you cannot help being conscious of your feeling of love or lack of it. Or to illustrate by another example, on a bitter, cold, thoroughly chilled day, if the senses are to be trusted, you enter a warm room heated by a furnace, and you at once exclaim, "How grateful is this sense of warmth!" So much so is this the case that you become conscious of it. Imagine, however, you had always lived in a summer temperature of 70 degrees Fahrenheit, we will say, such as many of the islands near the equator are supposed to possess. Could you then be conscious of this changed or altered sensation? In like manner, our consciousness of love or hate, hope or fear, joy or sorrow, are owing to imperfect and sensual states of these emotions. They do not, they cannot exist in a purely spiritual realm. Certainly, no man would dare to intimate that God, who is love, changeless love, ever felt this personal self-consciousness of love toward any being or thing he has made. No, not for the millionth part of an instant could he feel it, or he would cease to be God, were this possible, and it would pluck him from his throne. The lines of this poem come to mind. It would be rift within the lute that made all the music mute. I certainly shall not attempt to say what the divine consciousness is. Mortal mind cannot comprehend it. Undoubtedly, there may be, they must be, infinite modes and manifestations of its expressions, but surely our human sense of change cannot be in it, or God is not God, nor is love love. A third fact is that our human sense of will does not find expression in the changeless manifestations of divine love. I may will, may I not, to love a man, for my neighbour, for instance. Does not this imply the power or the disposition to will that, tomorrow, I will not love him? Here, it seems to me, is the fatal defect in Calvinism. It has invested God with personal qualities, such as are expressed in our human modes of love and hate. Calvinism, no doubt, has its uses in human history, in creating among debased peoples and nations a respect for law, authority and order, but it is simply human. It does nothing to explain and magnify in our hearts the infinitely higher sense of that love which is of God. You may ask, is God then to be conceived of as a human being with no will? Assuredly not, but the divine will is utterly unlike our human sense of will. the divine manifestations of God's will are not subject to the ebb and flow of caprice and passion as ours are. There is another point which cannot, must not be admitted. Love is, must be, omnipotent, since that is God, and God is love. I cannot stay to discuss the head of my discourse as freely as I could wish to, but one or two beautiful thoughts are suggested by it, which I cannot admit to call attention to. One is that its very stillness or quietness makes it all-powerful. The psalmist says, "Thy gentleness hath made me great." What is this statement of David's but a consciousness that all really great things are gentle, quiet, and unostentation? We have analogies in abundance in what our human sense calls the material world, which help to enforce this fact. Look up and behold yon glittering hosts of stars marshalled in their vast orbits and moving on with inconceivable swiftness. Yet how still, how noiselessly they advance, and have been advancing on their heavenly way throughout all ages. What a contrast to the rattle and roar of our mills, factories, cars, wagons and carts. Why, a baby's carriage trundle over the pavement makes more bustle 100,000 times than all yon starry hosts have made in all the millions of ages since they came forth from the voiceless stillness of the infinite mind. The chemist tells us that there is sufficient power residing in a single acre of grass, which we so heedlessly tread upon, to drive all the mills and steam cars on the globe, could be harnessed to the piston rod of the steam engine. Yet who of us ever dreamed of this mighty force? Why, a baby's fist can pull it up by the roots and play with it at will. And then you have this mighty voice, so mysterious, which is beginning to supplant steam. That is electricity. You can't see it or taste it. You cannot cut it with a knife or analyze it, yet what tireless, undreamed-of power lies coiled up in this force as it appears to the human senses. Mind you, I'm not calling these things real or enduring forces, for in science we learn that they are not. I employ them here simply as admirable illustrations of the truth of my statement regarding the unmeasured power that is in love, the only power there is when seen and realized from the spiritual side of the universe. But notice one more point under this heading. What will become of hate, fear, jealousy at last? They seem great forces to us. Men feel them, are swayed by them. Yet when our sinful consciousness of them disappears, how puny and insignificant they will appear. What also will become of the commonly held doctrine of retribution? I can easily see how to men under the thraldom of conscience, this dread dogma of endless retribution or torment is a logical sequence to their faiths. I have refrained from touching upon it, since humanity hitherto has not been ready for it, if it is even ready yet. To a sensual, material man or woman, hell seems as a police force, which it will not do to disturb, lest society be harmed and damaged by it. But when you come up into the light of the eternal day, and begin to get a realizing sense of the omnipotence of love, you must see that all these shadows of the night, your dark dogma of retribution included, will flee away. How can love be omnipotent and omnipresent if there be some subterranean pit where hate, arrogance, malice, lust and passion are perpetual forces? Before closing, two or three practical applications of this boundless theme must be touched upon. I am not without the fear that some minds, still under the dominion of the senses, will object to the view presented here, that it makes love to be tame and insipid, and God a being without force or character. What more insipid to our human sense than a man who has not strong likes and dislikes, who cannot be a good friend and a good hater also? But we must learn that by the rule of reversion, we gain the truth of being. Mortal mind makes its gods like itself, and we must unlearn all that we have learned here. Love, tame, insipid, jejune? Yes, to mortal sense it is. And nothing is more noticeable in the current speech of our age than that earnest and thoughtful men seldom make use of the word love. They even seem to have a dislike for it. Nor should it seem strange that this is so, when one reflects how weak and effeminate all our conceptions of love are. No wonder sensible people turn from it with loathing when it becomes womanish instead of divinely womanly and manly, as it surely is. Nothing is clearer than that our human conceptions, our figures of speech, must give place to a vision of love from the upper world ere the word love will become a power in our lives. And when that vision does dawn on us, the word love will be vested with new glories and wonders of grace. Then it will be seen that it is massive, stalwart, and transcendentally beautiful. Our second application is that we must not renounce the better modes and expressions of our finite and human sense, or relationships of love, till we can come into the higher ones. In gaining an impersonal sense of love, I am not to cease to love my brother or my friend any the less, but more. They are never to become less to me because I can rise high enough to see them as they all really are, one with all others in the true sense of being as God's children. And friends, it might be better not to talk of this sense of impersonality so much in stilted, set phrases of current Christian Science conversation, but to grow daily and hourly into the inner consciousness of its reality. But most important of all is the fact that we are to express this sense of love in practical ways. As he is, so are we in our innermost being. So are we here and now. Love saves us all from sin, from all sickness, and fully, completely realized, will deliver us from death. Here is the secret of Christian Science healing. It is to be found nowhere else. If love becomes the real law of our being, we cannot help healing others of their maladies, both of mind and body. Better than all, we shall gradually rise into that higher realm where our finite sense of love will fade out, so that it can be truthfully said of us, not that we love this or that friend, but that our nature is love itself. Surely, nothing less than this will suffice. For are we not, do we not reflect God? And if God is love, can his immortal reflection, the glorified man, be any less than love in its perfect, eternal reflection?